before we took a recess. The next case on the docket is Jody J. Hope versus Commonwealth. Ms. Barrows, do you want to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
We have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning again, Judge.
Can I ask you a quick question? The appendix at page 1133, the client acknowledged that no one pointed a gun or a knife at her. And then, as I understand, for self-defense, there needs to be evidence of an overt act indicative of imminent danger.
Yes.
Where is that evidence in this case?
I think the evidence is when you consider the fact that these two individuals are advancing towards her. She has not advancing towards her, walking towards her. One of them has his hands in his pocket. They're making threats to her, her family, the place where she lives, those kinds of things, along with the fact that she has knowledge that these gentlemen, less than 3 hours before, committed a violent act on her, one of her family members, her husband, Mr. Cotton, and had obviously the capabilities of committing these violent acts, not just through the punch to his face, but with the knife that was obviously big enough to slash four of this gentleman's tires. So I think taking all that together, there certainly is enough to at least support the jury instruction on self-defense as it relates to both individuals. Now, I think we have to be careful not to decide whether or not this is, in fact, self-defense. We just have to, the job of this court and the job of the analysis here is, was there enough evidence for it to go to the jury for them
to
understand?
That was, of course, not put to you.
Certainly. And I think based on those facts, that evidence, the fact that it was brought up by Ms. Hope in her testimony and corroborated by Ms. Martin in her testimony, that certainly was enough to support, it's a scintilla of the evidence that's enough to support that instruction as it relates to both individuals. And so that's why, with our first assignment of error, with the jury instruction, the fact that these two gentlemen were kind of parsed out from one another unilaterally by the judge. I think this parsing out certainly gives us our first issue here, which is the preservation issue and the fact that there is no proper instruction in the record. I realize that, generally speaking, that's how we have to preserve jury instruction issues. However, the fact that there is still this set of jury instructions about self-defense as it relates to Dorsey Harris gets us to the point where we can have, there is a conversation on the record, there is an argument on the record about the self-defense instruction.
How can we consider the appropriateness of an instruction if we don't have the instruction?
Well, I think with the argument given by counsel prior to the trial court making its decision, where they're talking about the self-defense instruction, the fact that there is still a self-defense instruction for Dorsey Harris, that gets us
are they talking about the self-defense instruction, or are they talking about is defense counsel talking about the self-defense instruction or self-defense?
They're talking about the self-defense instruction during the period of time where before Judge Spencer makes her decision about whether or not she's going to grant certain instructions. The entire conversation is about the self-defense instruction as well as a number of other instructions that were proffered by both sides. So they're having a conversation about the self-defense instructions. And it's clear that the trial court understood that conversation to the extent that she obviously went back to chambers and looked at the self-defense instruction and, by my understanding and my interpretation of the record, changed that instruction to eliminate...
The best case that supports you is the case of Bryant versus Commonwealth. And Bryant, the Supreme Court stated, quote, we adhere to the rule that the trial court is not required to amend or correct an erroneous instruction, but the rule is subject to the limitation that when the principle of law is materially vital to a defendant in a criminal case, it is reversible error for the trial court to refuse a defective instruction instead of correcting it and giving it to the proper form. The problem that I see in this case, and help me get by the problem that I have, is that, relating to Judge Haley's question, with all of the circumstances that were factually underpinning this case, how is this instruction materially vital to your client?
Because the entire case hinged on her self-defense argument, from the opening statement, through the lines of questioning, through closing arguments.
But setting aside the argument, and I appreciate your response, but setting aside the argument on the issue, factually, what do we have to support self-defense?
We have her testimony. We have her coming in and saying, taking the responsibility that comes with raising a self-defense defense, I did this, but I did this because I was in fear of my life. Now,
but don't we have to also go through the baffle of whether or not her reasonable apprehension of death or of serious bodily injury was reasonable under the circumstances when the victim in the case that was killed hadn't done anything vis-a-vis their connection or relationship or whatever?
Well, I don't think we need to go that far with the analysis. That's for the jury to decide. What we have to decide, is there some sort of support in the record for this instruction? Yes, there is. Her testimony that I was afraid of these gentlemen, I was responding in self-defense.
But didn't the trial judge sort of deal with that, and that there was a self-defense instruction provided with regard to one of the victims in the case, but yet not the other? So wasn't there a determination that self-defense, factually, as it was presented in this case, was appropriate in some context, but not in the entire context?
I don't dispute that the court made that decision. My problem is that that decision was incorrect based on the facts. Jody, as she goes through her testimony, consistently refers to both of these gentlemen.
What decision was wrong based upon the facts?
The decision to exclude Antonio Harris from the self-defense instruction.
Following up on what Judge Austin said, is it your view if you just a defendant testifies, I was afraid, that justifies the self-defense instruction?
As a defense attorney, yes, I would say that that would support a self-defense instruction. And
say I was afraid is enough.
I understand the court's concern, and I think perhaps if that was just the evidence that we had,
well,
that would not
I
be enough.
Coming back to what evidence is there?
Yes,
that's the question.
Right, and I think the evidence is that she says not only is she afraid, but that these gentlemen are walking towards her.
Okay.
These gentlemen that she has information about, that she knows how they've acted previously. And the fact.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, she goes there knowing how they've acted previously.
Yes.
She arrives, drives there, goes in and out of this place. And is it enough that one brother then is particularly aggressive, apparently, and the other brother is still just there with him, that she, therefore, having known what both brothers did in beating up her boyfriend, is that enough to justify a self-defense instruction for the brother that is not as aggressive or assertive?
Well, I think you have that information, but again, it's them walking towards her, these threats that are being made, and again, her knowledge that they've acted in concert previously. And so, again, I'm not trying to argue that this is... trial counsel kept arguing that this was a classic case of self-defense. I don't know that the case was that strong. But what I do know is that you've got this defendant who has come in, taken on this self-defense approach, says, yes, I committed this crime. And so when you do that, you have to fully commit to taking responsibility for doing this. And then she asked...
What does that have to do? What does that statement you just made have to do with whether or not there's evidence to support self-defense?
Because she comes in, she says, this is the experience that I had, this is what these gentlemen did to me. And
what could they do to her?
They walked towards her, they made statements to her and her family, they made threats to her and her family, and they had acted violently previously less than 3 hours beforehand. So I think that taken together gets us to the point where we're at a self-defense instruction. It's a fundamental fairness issue.
On that, I mean, I understand the walking toward, and certainly there's evidence that Dorsey did that. But are you arguing that because they said, okay, I know where you... know where your kids are, and they say to the mother-in-law, Ms. Martin, you know, your boyfriend who sits on that porch, he's dead. If, because we know where he is it your argument that therefore she can act preemptively here?
Well, I think it's an imminent threat given how close they are to each other.
But the threats are made about people who are not present.
Sure.
So it cannot be imminent, can it?
I think it can be, because
how can it be imminent if the person against whom the threat is then is somewhere else,
and
located somewhere else?
And I think what we have to remember is he's also telling her to say goodbye. So I think that there's some sort of threat that could be taken from, okay, well, I have to say goodbye because there's a threat to me as well. And so I think, given the fact that they're walking towards, one of them has a hand in a pocket with presumably a knife there, that taken all together, that gets us to this. Because the knife was used to slash the tires. Mr. Dorsey Harris had used the knife previously. As far as the standard goes,
what does Antonio Harris say? Does he display a knife?
He does not display a knife. He does not make statements. However, he is walking towards Miss Hope with his brother. And again, he's acted previously with his brother in their violent offenses.
So now, do I gather from what you just said that the only overact indicative of imminent danger by Antonio is walking towards your client?
It's walking towards my client with his brother, who is also issuing very violent threats.
But Antonio says nothing.
He does not, but he is walking with him. He is obviously acting with him. And so, again,
doesn't she say that Dorsey actually comes toward her, but she doesn't say that of Antonio, right? I mean, they're walking, everybody's walking along around this place where they've gathered, pizza place or whatever it is. But doesn't she make a distinction, your client in her testimony, that Dorsey is approaching, whereas Antonio is just sort of there walking along?
I think the distinction only comes because there is a focus in the questioning about Dorsey because he's the one that has his hand in the pocket. I don't think that the omission of discussing Antonio means that he's not walking towards. And I think Ms. Martin's testimony also supports that they're both approaching at the same time. So I see that I've gotten into my rebuttal time without getting into the second issue.
Well, we've asked you a lot of questions.
Sure.
You can reserve and cover that when you come back, or you can proceed. I'll give you a little extra time.
Okay, and I'm happy to give up a little bit of my rebuttal time to get into the second issue. Obviously, the second issue here is the balance of the statement that should have been introduced.
Counsel, let me suggest this to you. I've got a lot of very interesting questions to ask Ms. Tyson on this issue, so why don't you save your rebuttal for that?
I will take the court's lead on that. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think I want to talk about the first issue before I get my interesting questions
I'll let you get your tires on the ground.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't want to waive my argument that I think that the instruction is necessary in this case. And I know that the case that I cited, Shake, was unpublished, but it discussed Bryant and Oliver. And that simply because there is a discussion of the instruction is not sufficient, we really need to have the instruction in the record so this court can see precisely what it is that the trial court did not give. And so, again, I don't want to waive that argument. I think that it is an argument, especially since this court did rule that way in Shake a few years ago. As to the merits of the self-defense instruction, I think it's very important to remember that the judge did give a self-defense instruction with regard to the wounding of Dorsey Harris. I'm looking on page 1052 to 1053 of the appendix, where the defendant is testifying that she turned around and she saw Dorsey. That's line 10. And she felt afraid, and she started firing. She is afraid because of what Dorsey is saying on 1053. After he had uttered those statements, what did Dorsey Harris do? He was walking towards me, making those comments to me. So it's not Antonio and Dorsey, it's Dorsey. And the defendant received a self-defense instruction with regard to Dorsey. In order to have a self-defense instruction, or in order to have self-defense, there must, understand, be some overt act indicative of imminent danger. And imminent danger is a real threat to one's safety. And the amount of force must be reasonable in relation to that threat. Antonio Harris, at the time of the shooting, was simply with his brother. Now, Mrs. Martin testified that during the time when Black and Sean Cotton and everybody was all there together, she testified that she saw Dorsey with a knife, but that he put it away before Sean Cotton left Southside Plaza.
Let me take her mm-hmm. argument a step further just to see how far the analysis and analytical framework you would provide would go. Suppose I'd had some sort of dispute with some individual, and the individual had made certain threats against me. Said, you know, Rossi, I'm going to get you, or Rossi, I'm going to hurt you bad the next time I see you. And I don't see this person for 2 or 3 days. And let's suppose one night I'm walking home, and I see this same individual who has made these threats to me, and he's coming forward with 2 or 3 other menacing-looking people. And let's assume for the sake of discussion that I have authorization to have a handgun. And I'm thinking to myself, no, these guys are coming to hurt me. I've been basically put on notice that they're coming to hurt me bad. And so they start walking toward me, and I shoot, and I miss, let's say, and I hit one of the other guys that's with this person who's threatening. Would I be entitled in that context, and I know that's not exactly what we have here, to a self-defense instruction if I did, as counsel suggests, provided the predicate by getting onto the witness stand and saying, I was really afraid, this guy had threatened me, he told me he was going to get me, I knew that, and I'm going to add some extra facts, I knew that he was real friends with these guys, and these were really mean guys, and I did what I thought I needed to do to protect myself. But I'd be entitled to that instruction.
No, I would say understand that you're not. And if I remember the facts of Sands, and I hope I'm not confusing it with another case, that was the husband and the wife, and they'd had a history.
Yep.
But there wasn't that imminent threat, that overt act that caused a threat of imminent danger to the safety at that time. And that was a very much shorter period of time than the example that you gave. So I would say no. Sean Cotton, during the time of
why wouldn't it be reasonable for me to argue as counsel in that case to a trial judge that, judge, I appreciate that that's how you feel the circumstances are, but at least the jury should be able to consider whether or not my response to that environment that I was in was reasonable or not, so thereby giving me the benefit of that self-defense instruction.
I would again go back to the case, and the case law, that there needs to be that overt act indicative of imminent danger, and the fact that at some prior time that may inform how you feel, but if the facts don't present to meet the requirements under Sands, then no, you're not entitled to the self-defense instruction. And of course, in this case, it's a much different situation because there clearly is one party who is much more menacing than the other party. And the
so
menacing.
If I added a fact, just to see how far you'd go with this, if I added a fact, if the guy who had said this really nasty thing to me 3 days earlier said, hey, there's Rossi, we're going to jack him up now, and another person said, yeah, let's go get him.
We're getting closer to getting the self-defense instruction at that point because now we're getting into the imminent.
So you would argue that in the context of this case, Antonio simply being there and offering nothing to support the reasonable fear that the appellant in this case had doesn't allow her to cross the threshold of arguing self-defense.
No, he doesn't. I want to point out that it really is there's a real difference between these two parties. Cotton heard what was going on over the telephone, and he heard Dorsey's voice. As I said, Ms. Martin, 870 to 875, if you read that, you can tell there's one of them, and that is Dorsey who is making the threat. I do want to say that in addition to all of the discussion that we've had so far, that even if this court were to entertain the possibility that there was error, that error would be harmless for two very specific reasons. And that is, number one, the jury had the option of finding the defendant guilty of voluntary manslaughter with regard to Antonio Harris, which would have been a non-malicious intentional act. And instead, the jury chose to convict of second-degree murder, which is an intentional malicious act. The jury, having made that determination, there's no way that the jury would have agreed to self-defense, which is a non-malicious intentional act that is excused or justified. They rejected that option when they rejected manslaughter, and perhaps
one being an affirmative defense and one being an element of proof necessary to support a greater charge.
And yet, you're right, yes, and yet they're the malicious and non-malicious and the intentional, if you look at the elements, the jury having made the decision, this is Turner, this is the Turner case, the jury having decided to convict up here, we've got something here they rejected, then it's harmless error with regard to this. And perhaps my stronger argument for harmless error is that the jury rejected self-defense for Dorsey Harris, who clearly was the more menacing of the two. He's the one who had made the comments, and in fact they convicted with regard to the highest level that they could for Dorsey Harris.
Let's switch gears.
Yes, indeed, Your Honor.
Let's talk about the second case, and I'm going to give you the analytical framework that I'd like to try to work from. In the Jones case, and I'm sure you've read Jones,
yes.
Commonwealth sought to impeach the defendant by excerpting some of the questions and answers from his videotaped interview. Jones then sought to introduce the entire videotape to rehabilitate his credibility and provide context for the information provided in the interview versus the information testified at trial. On appeal, this court held that the videotape was in fact admissible in full because it was not hearsay, the videotape was not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, but rather to provide context for Jones' statement and to rehabilitate his credibility. Aren't the facts in our case even stronger than Jones?
No, because in Jones what happened was Jones had, first of all, had given that statement to the police, which I think could be a significant factor, and perhaps we'll get to that, but this is a conversation with a fiancé on the telephone that we're talking about. And he was impeached because he didn't tell the police everything that he was testifying to at trial. And he was being impeached because the prosecutor was saying, well, you didn't tell the officer this and you didn't tell the officer that. And so he was entitled, according to the court, to explain the circumstances around the interview that he was giving. For instance, he wasn't being asked the same questions by the police officer. It was the context. It's almost, to use the language in the rule about completeness, that fairness required that this videotape be played so the jury could see, well, what were the questions that the officer asked him?
But a broad reading of Jones would suggest that if the prosecution wants to go forward with excerpted material from an interview of sorts or some sort of a statement that the defendant made, that the entire context of that should be admissible. For instance, suppose a person is on the phone talking and the police somehow have a videotape of that discussion, and the defendant who is being prosecuted says, yeah, I meant to kill him, and then laughs and says, come on, you know I didn't really mean to kill that person. And then the prosecution wants to admit simply that portion where he says, yeah, I wanted to kill them, without the additional information to show the context and the like. Why isn't it important that the fact finder have the entire context of that conversation and then make the determination as to what they want to believe or not believe?
Well, and I think that the case that you've posited is somewhat similar to that old Bowman case, which defense counsel cited and we distinguished, where the officer arrives at the crime scene and the defendant says, I shot him, but I had to save my life. And the officer testifies to the I shot him, but is not permitted to testify to that, but he saved my life. I think the facts are so very different here because this, as I say, is a conversation with a loved one, a family member, a friend. It's happens to be with her fiancé. And this is not a statement that she's giving to the police. It's nothing that is official. And so it falls into statements of this nature would be an out-of-court statement offered.
She also acknowledges, doesn't she, at the beginning, I was watching the videotape with this, well, I didn't see it.
Yes.
And then, but it would be really helpful if Ms. Martin would say that she did.
Right.
And, that's sort of an acknowledgement almost against interest, as well as a question of what she said versus in Jones, which I'm rather familiar with, was a question of he didn't say this.
Yes.
And so the context, well, why didn't you say it? Because he was impeached about it. Is that...
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I think that's important. I also think that it's important that when we're talking about a prior consistent statement, which, of course, you didn't get to in Jones. That was not the basis of the Jones decision. But this is not something that is consistent with her trial testimony. She didn't say anyone came at her with a knife when she testified. And so this, to the extent that that's the portion that she wanted to get in, at the end of the statement where she says he was coming at us with a knife, I'm really sorry that this happened, that is not consistent with what she had said. This is being offered by the party who made it in favor of the party who made it, and that violates the evidence rule. And I think that it's interesting that when you look at the rule, which is 2:106, the rule of completeness, that the last sentence of that rule is that if you want to get in something that is in fairness, the jury needs to hear it so they're not misled, so that it's not unfair, there's a caveat at the end that as long as it doesn't violate the rules of evidence. Well, this violated the rules of evidence because it was being offered, the party's out-of-court statement was being offered on behalf of the party.
So to get to your argument, we would have to make a determination that either this information is hearsay or not exempted hearsay. To make it to the point that you want to make, we have to say that this is rank hearsay.
Yes, sir, and it is. It is hearsay. And they wanted to get in as an exception to hearsay.
If we were to determine that it is indeed not hearsay, where would you fall?
Then I think we'd be in the prior consistent statement area, and if there is, this is not prior consistent statement because this is not the way that the defendant testified at trial. So it doesn't qualify as a prior consistent statement if that is the purpose for which the tape was to be introduced. I do want to be sure that I mention, I think we have a harmless error argument with regard to this as well. Obviously, it's our position that the court did not err in the rulings that it made, but the reason that it's harmless is if you look at this statement, there is a lot of actually inculpatory material in the statement as well as exculpatory. Actually, on 1340 of the appendix, the detective testifies with regard to a little bit of what she said. He testified that Hope had told the person on the phone, Sean Cotton, that she had told the detective that the brother had threatened her and Martin. And, of course, she did testify that there were threats. And so the entire conversation is proffered at 11:59 through 60. And it includes things such as, don't call me on my phone, and the snippet that was already introduced, and that she was telling the police the minimum that she could, and that... Don't say anything, advising him not to speak. So as far as the overall context here, this is not as helpful as it could be. It is not a prior consistent statement. It does not fall under a hearsay exception, and the court did not err in this regard. The court did not err in regard to not giving the self-defense instruction with regard to the homicide, and that instruction does not appear in the record in any event. And so for all of these reasons, we would encourage this court and we would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the Circuit Court of the City of Richmond. Thank you.
Ms. Burrows, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. Yes. So in terms of the second issue that we talked about with Jones, first and foremost, it's not hearsay because I think it's pretty clear from the record that the statement is not being offered for the truth. It is being offered to rehabilitate Ms. Hope's credibility on her redirect examination, and eventually obviously tried to offer it when it was not able to be introduced that way.
I understand the purpose, but what hearsay exception or exemption would you identify to allow the admissibility?
The fact that Ms. Hope was impeached by the Commonwealth, because the use of that statement by the Commonwealth was to insinuate you weren't actually acting in self-defense, you're lying here today. And so
you're going to where Ms. Tyson was pointing, that you were suggesting that it's a prior consistent statement. Where's the other statement that would rehabilitate her?
Well, I think the balance of her statement where she's saying that she is afraid, that she was acting out of fear, indicates, it supports what she was saying at trial, which is that she is afraid of these gentlemen, and that's why she acted that way. I know the Commonwealth makes a lot of her stating, you know, don't talk to the police, be quiet, and things like that. I don't think that's as negative as the Commonwealth is making it out to be. I think that there is definitely a way for defense counsel to have handled that to say, absolutely, she's trying to protect herself and enjoy her constitutional rights not to make statements. That's not a harmful aspect of this conversation. But I think the broader picture here, especially with the Jones case and with this, the balance of this statement, it's a fundamental fairness. We can't hide the ball with the jury on this. Clearly, the context that the Commonwealth was trying to use was hurtful. But there's a lot more in that statement that is helpful for the defendant, that is admissible, and the jury should have been able to hear it. And so, again, the fundamental fairness, I think, stretches to the other issue as well. yes, there is a lot of overwhelming evidence against Ms. Hope, but she was entitled to have and raise her own defense to this, which she did. She was entitled to have the jury instructed as to both individuals, Dorsey and Antonio, and she was also entitled to have the jury hear the balance of her statement. And since those things were kept from her, we're asking the court to reverse the case and order a new trial.
Can I answer one more question?
Sure.
Ms. Tyson has suggested, assuming that we actually agree that Jones applies here, that this case could be resolved by a harmless error analysis. And wasn't there some testimony in the record that Cotton actually testified about what was discussed over the telephone with the appellant? So the information actually got out there anyway.
Well, I think the reason it's not harmless is because, again, with the impeachment issue, the entirety of a self-defense argument comes down to the credibility of the person raising that defense.
But the rehabilitation of that particular statement was accomplished through Cotton's testimony, wasn't it?
Well, I think the problem is that the Commonwealth was able to portray Ms. Hope as perhaps lying about her self-defense issue. And so to the extent that this, the balance of the statement directly rehabilitates her, that, to me, takes it out of the harmless error and into a constitutional error.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burke. We had a lot of questions. I think we lost the time there.